Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. Hello and welcome to the second season of Golau, where we hope to provide the finest Brexit talk for your Brexit ears. That audible groan in the background gives me the opportunity to introduce my guests for today, Professor Roger Scully.
Hello.
Dr. Joe Hunt.
Hello.
And Dr. Hugh Pritchard.
Hello.
Big week in terms of Brexit. We've had the second reading, we've had the motion to proceed into committee stage now, we have amendments coming out of our ears, and I am going to invite Dr. Joe Hunt, who was the organiser of an event on the day following the second reading in central London that invited a number of MPs, a number of experts to discuss some of the issues that came out of it. And Joe, I wonder if I could ask you to give us a summary of the kind of thoughts that were circulating at that event.
Well, the event itself was an opportunity to come together and take a closer look at this EU withdrawal bill. And it's the sort of domestic side of things that whatever future relationship we might have with the European Union, we have to get our sort of constitutional legal house in order here in the UK, and what we're going to do with the 40 plus years of EU law that has found its way one way or the other into UK law, into Welsh law as well. And what do we do to ensure that there are no huge legal black holes when withdrawal day comes, when exit day comes, which will, we assume, be 29th of March 2019. Thank you. So the withdrawal bill is that piece of legislation that's being proposed that will handle that process of moving forward. Something is needed. Whether this is the best that could be achieved is most definitely open for debate. And there are some key issues that come out there, some key concerns about what the bill does. I mean, it seeks to roll forward and sort of continue the laws that we already have and then to sort of secure them as part of UK law. But it also has to give wide-ranging powers to ministers to put into effect any agreement that's reached. And so there are so three main areas that came up during the day, some areas of focus, of concern around that. And the and is, of course, delegated powers, the range of powers that have been given to ministers and whether there are appropriate controls over them, the powers that they have. There's the position of rights and their enforcement, and there are concerns about the sort of human rights implications of all of this, and also how what we do with things like the Charter, because the Charter of Human Rights, Fundamental Rights, which is not being rolled forward. And then finally, and particularly pertinent to us sat in the room, is the issue of devolution and what it does with the devolution agreements, the devolution settlements, and particular concerns there that this might be seen as something of a re-centralisation of powers.
I thought one of the really interesting things that came out of that event was there were groups of comments about the technical construction of the bill. And we had one of the officials from the Department for Exiting the EU kicked off the event with outlining how the civil servants had gone about drafting the bill. And it went down a number of different interesting routes, including squirrel racing. And we'll make sure that we publish that the link to that content when it's available. But then there was also the political interpretation of the bill. There seemed to be a lot of comments about how the bill could be improved technically. Mm. And then there was the huge swathe or range of opinions about how the bill could be improved from depending on your political viewpoint. And I thought that was very interesting, the way that the different people attending that event discussed those two different aspects.
There is a fundamental tension running throughout the day that for those who feel that this bill is fundamentally wrong-headed and it's not salvageable as it is, and others that, you know, we'll just get on with the business of it and just do what we can changing the detail, but that there are some really big concerns about the threat to our constitutional stability. One of the speakers on the first morning panel who was responding to the DEXU official, you know, Shona Douglas-Scott, was very, very impassioned about her concerns for the continuation of the British constitution as it stands.
It was particularly interesting, the event, from a Welsh perspective, because at the time that we were about to run a panel about the impact of the EU withdrawal bill on devolved settlements, we heard the news via Twitter about the publication, the joint publication by FM Scotland and FM Wales, of their memoranda about the LCM for the EU withdrawal bill, which I think even David Davis has accepted the bill will now require an LCM from both of the two devolved administrations. Could you tell us a little bit about what the FMs have presented in those memoranda?
Well, if you look at the bill when it was first published, the explanatory notes are quite clear and quite open that you do need a legislative consent motion. So that was the first thing we were looking for, or one of the first things we were looking for when the bill was published, really, was would the UK government accept that the consent motion was required? And to be fair with them, they're quite open in the explanatory notes saying, yes, for most parts, a legislative consent motion is required. And that obviously gives the Scotland and Wales government some more cards to play with when this bill is going through.
Because that the LCM process, of course, is that also referred to as the Sewell Convention. The constitutional practice that the UK Parliament would not normally legislate on matters that fall within devolved powers, except where they have the consent of the devolved. What we know following an earlier judgment from the Supreme Court in the Miller case around the Article 50 case that was brought by Gina Miller is that whilst that is sort of recognised as a constitutional rule, it's not a legally enforceable one. So, well, the government has recognised that on a reading of it that it's required, you know, if they're not given, and at the moment we know the First Ministers, both Scotland and Wales, are saying that they do not at the moment recommend that consent is given, what might we expect to see then? It then falls into the realm of politics.
Yes, and I was just thinking as you were saying that, Joe, I mean, if there is one circumstance which would surely qualify for the, you know, phrase not normally, it is Brexit. And Brexit is the most complicated thing that the British state has tried to do since it fought World War II. I mean, these are not remotely normal circumstances. So there's quite a get out there. I mean, Joe was just mentioning, though, there the politics is. I mean, I think the politics of the alliance, as we might call it, between Nicola Sturgeon and Carwyn Jones are fascinating. I mean, this is a Labour First Minister in Wales working very closely with an SNP First Minister in Scotland. I mean, if we consider just how utterly toxic have been the relations between those two political parties for many years, to see them working this week and in their earlier joint statement so incredibly closely in alliance against the UK Prime Minister, I mean, that politically is a quite extraordinary thing to do. And I think is a measure of the political failure of the UK government thus far and the way that they've managed this process. I mean, Carwyn Jones is essentially a devolutionist unionist. He is a member of a party which is firmly committed to Wales and the rest of the, you know, being part of the UK, but the UK as a whole staying together. And yet the extremely maladroit approach of the UK government has actually driven him into an alliance with the SNP First Minister. And, you know, politically that is a quite extraordinary thing to have happened. And as I say, I think a measure of the UK government's political failure.
The chance of somebody like Nicola Sturgeon being able to work with Cadwyn Jones, for example, who, whilst being a unionist and whilst being, you know, a senior Labour figure, is also, I think, not unfairly criticised from time to time for having soft nationalist leanings. And he is certainly at the forefront of putting forward a confederal approach for the UK. He is certainly, would it be a different Labour figure? I mean, if we could roll back or put in another figure, say, from the past, Neil Kinnock, for example, was First Minister of Wales. Wales would be a very different place. But the chances of any kind of cooperation between someone like Nicola Sturgeon and Neil Kinnock would be zero. So it's all about the spectrum there. I wonder also, is the coordination between the two first ministers also itself unusual, a not normal circumstance?
Yes. I mean, if you look at the personal politics, I mean, Carwyn Jones has very much been towards the, you know, the strongly devolutionist and maybe soft cultural nationalist wing of the Welsh Labour Party. And he's actually been talking quite radically about the UK constitution for some years. And for a number of years, it seems if he was saying these things and getting pretty much no response, even within his own political party. But the circumstances of Brexit, and also I think the fact that Carwyn Jones is a significantly politically strengthened figure after the success of the Welsh Labour campaign that he headed in the general election, have boosted his credibility here. And I think on the Scottish side, you see Nicola Sturgeon leading a government and a party that have had a recent political setback in the general election, and I think are having to look more seriously now at, restructuring the UK, not just thinking about leaving the UK. And so, you know, both of these figures, I think, are sort of to some degree being pushed by circumstance as well as their own personal preferences towards working together. But, you know, I think the fact that they've been able to do so and find such an enormous degree of common ground on this, it does also reflect the extremely poor handling of intergovernmental relations and aspects of the drafting of these bills by the UK government. And what we've seen, for instance, in evidence previously to the Commons Brexit Committee by both Mark Drakeford, the Welsh minister responsible, and Mike Russell, the Scottish minister responsible for Brexit, absolutely scathing evidence being given about the handling of the Joint Ministerial Committee by the UK government. You know, there's been clearly an extremely large amount of very clumsy political dealing, which has enabled a Welsh and Scottish governments who do not come from the same constitutional political direction at all, nonetheless to find themselves working in alliance at the moment extremely closely.
And that looks set to continue, at least if we look at the statements around the legislative consent memoranda. You've got referenced in here the fact that Wales and Scotland are expecting to work together, and they're coming together to draft joint amendments. So we're going to see those suggested from the Scottish and Welsh government, and that they can find that commonality.
How would you summarise the potential effect of the EU withdrawal bill as it is now on the devolved settlements? What is it that has prompted the Welsh and Scots governments to work in this manner?
Well, if we go back to the white paper on the EU withdrawal bill, where the UK government said that powers would be kept centrally for the moment and then passed down or devolved when appropriate, or the appropriate powers in the future.
This is the infamous holding pattern.
The holding pattern, yeah. That's exactly what they've done in the bill. But obviously the Scottish government and the Welsh government come from quite a polar opposite position of these powers are devolved powers and so should automatically be devolved once Brexit is over. That brings them together in one sense, that they come from the same perspective. But the thing with the bill is it sort of treats both the same. It's, although there's some technical differences, it freezes those elements of devolved law, doesn't give the scope for either Parliament or Assembly to legislate and even legislate on what they're doing now. So it's this element of being frozen. We've heard the term being clawed back. And so that's the opposition.
You've heard of the naked power grab. Yeah. You know, the language used within the legislative consent memoranda, you know, Carwin Jones refers to it as an unnecessary and unacceptable centralisation of powers, that those areas which at the moment are explicitly devolved and conferred under the current Wales Act, and when we move to a reserved powers model, will not be part of those reserved areas, that there are clear restrictions being placed on what the devolved administrations and legislatures can do in those areas. The key issue is this one in Clause 11, that at the moment we have EU law is supreme, and it requires national, subnational legislatures, bodies to act in compliance with EU law, to give effect to EU law, but also to do things that don't conflict with the free movement principles and things like that. So it sets a set of requirements. And what we have in the devolution legislation at the moment is a clear statement of that. We have a Westminster Parliament that is under pure interpretation of parliamentary sovereignty. It has this absolute range of powers. It can do anything it likes. But when we look at what can happen in the devolved, is there are clear limits on what their assemblies and legislatures can do. And that's all set out in legislation. And one of those limitations is that they cannot take measures that would be in conflict with EU law. And what Clause 11 does is say, we're going to lift that constraint that's set by EU law, but replace it with a new constraint that says you cannot do anything that conflicts with retained, derived EU law. So this is that's rolled over. But, you know, who's deciding, you know, when that may change? Who's deciding? You know, so this is within those devolved areas. There is no freedom to make their own decisions in areas which are, on the face of it, devolved. So when we've got this process of moving to a reserved powers model, what we've got through the withdrawal bill is essentially a return to a conferred powers model, because it's saying you can't legislate on these things unless we've created a common framework that we're happy with and unless there is an order in council, otherwise that returns the powers. So it's very much sort of saying No, Westminster is still supreme.
One of the things that came up in the event on Tuesday, there was a couple of questions that kind of tested the water to see, from the devolved's point of view, are the flaws in the bill technical flaws, i.e. drafting flaws? Is it just poorly drafted? Or are these political choices that are being made? Because there were some people who were simply saying, you know, it's just badly drafted. There were other people, and I think one of the comments I remember asked whether these changes, particularly with regards to agriculture, were being put in complete control of the UK Parliament so that the UK Parliament could then freely negotiate international trade agreements on agriculture and would have complete authority to set those standards, and the devolved would just have to live with it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very interesting question. It sort of goes back to the heart of the problems with this EU withdrawal bill is it poorly drafted? Are these political choices, or is it in a mixture of both?
There are clear political choices here. There are political choices, and there are obviously some within Westminster Parliament that do not necessarily acknowledge the fact of devolution, that do not see this as an issue, that of course these things are coming back to Westminster, and of course Westminster Parliament remains absolute. And there's something of a trying to find that common ground with how you approach this in a sort of coherent way, the criticisms of the legislation in a coherent way, because there's a lot of criticism around the relationship between the executive and Parliament and how this is, you know, we want to see a reassertion of parliamentary sovereignty and parliamentary supremacy. Well, that is a problem from a devolution perspective because the devolution settlements are all inherently sort of predicated, well, they are there because of the grace of the principle of parliamentary sovereignty, that seeking an attempt to sort of redefine what we understand by parliamentary sovereignty and parliamentary supremacy. They're, you know, from a devolved perspective, we challenge that principle of parliamentary supremacy. So seeking to reinforce it, have an argument for that, is problematic from a devolved position.
Yeah, I mean, there is a fundamental philosophical difference here between the sort of position that's been advocated by the First Minister and the Welsh Government in their recent paper on Brexit, which is looking towards some sort of confederal union where the different parliaments and governments are negotiating, at least in some areas, much more as equals, where we're having genuine sort of shared rule within the UK, where these different institutions cooperate in the allocation of resources and distribution of powers across the UK. Difference between that point of view and the sort of much more traditional Westminster is sovereign view, which seems to be dominant within the current Conservative government. And I think to at least some extent, you know, those are not differences which can simply be split down the middle. And unless there is some sort of change in the mindset in Whitehall and Westminster, then there is likely to be very substantial conflict over this.
In the Welsh context, it seems that the key to all of this is the Labour Party. I think it's very telling that when we were in London a few days ago, Hilary Benn was explicitly talking about parliamentary sovereignty and how important it was to the entire debate that was had on Tuesday. However, just a few months ago, here in the Cardiff Business School, the First Minister, when he published the paper that Roger just referred to, he explicitly said the era of parliamentary sovereignty is dead. At the same time, it's quite telling that the First Minister has had a huge influence on the UK Labour Party response to the withdrawal bill because devolution is right at the top of the list.
Yes, I mean, some of these philosophical differences run, I think, within particularly the Labour Party rather than between, say, Labour and the Conservatives. But I think the two things which are quite clear, one is that the First Minister is a significantly strengthened political figure after the general election, where, you know, he very much was front and centre of the Labour campaign here in Wales, and it was a very successful campaign, and he's accrued substantial political capital out of that. And the other point is simply that the Labour Party are, I think, quite deliberately using problems around devolution as a political club with which to beat the government and, you know, to make the UK government's already extremely difficult life just a little bit more difficult.
What do we know about how the Assembly is going to respond to the withdrawal bill?
Well, I think it's politically very likely that, you know, the Labour group there will support the First Minister and Plaid Cymru will support, you know, that sort of line or an even harder one. So there's going to be clear majority support in the Assembly for the loss of the position to be taken already, trying to maintain membership of the single market or something as close to it as functionally possible, looking out for core economic interests, such as those of Welsh agriculture, those of Welsh exporters. So, I mean, those sorts of lines are going to be advanced very strongly. I think there may be some politically rather difficult times for the Welsh Conservative group in the Assembly, because you will have at least some loyalty to the UK government, but at the same time, on some of these issues, may well be aware that there are extremely pressing economic incentives and needs for the Welsh economy, which will need to be upheld in some overall final deal.
Do we know if the Welsh Conservative group and the UKIP group in the Senedd have put out position papers or any kind of publication about their response to Brexit? I mean, I'm not aware of anything. Do we know?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
So is it...
The UKIP group and the Assembly are barely functioning as a group these days with all the various internal problems within UKIP.
It just strikes me as odd that there doesn't seem to have been any... coming from a position of strength after Andrew R.T. Davis backed Brexit wholeheartedly, I think it's fair to say, there hasn't been any distinctive Conservative voice on Brexit in Wales.
No, well, most Conservative AMs, of course, backed Remain, which is one thing. I mean, just as with the Labour Party and some other matters, you know, a lot of these divisions run within the Conservative Party, not between the Conservatives and others. I think, you know, frankly, the line of quite a lot of Conservative AMs has largely been sort of to keep their head down and hope that things can be resolved by the UK government. This is, you know, politically very difficult territory for the Conservative Party, and is likely to get more difficult.
It's interesting, particularly given the position of Ruth Davidson in Scotland, who has, you know, clearly set her stall out as a Scottish Conservative leader. And there was some talk before the summer recess that the Welsh Conservative Group Party was starting to try and see if it could adopt some of the Scottish model in sort of semi-autonomous state. I don't know if has that progressed at all.
Well, I think those discussions are sort of ongoing within the party. I mean, there are at least a couple of obstacles in the way of those sorts of things being implemented. I mean, first of all, that I think a lot of the membership are fairly unenthusiastic, and secondly, that frankly, the Welsh Party is, certainly as I understand it, financially quite dependent on the party in London. It wouldn't be very easily able to stand on its own two feet financially. An immediate other practical difficulty, I think, would be if you're going to have a much clearer Welsh Conservative leader, there isn't really a very obvious outstanding candidate for the job at the moment.
One of the things that was mooted ahead of the summer recess was a continuity bill. What form does that take?
Well, the Assembly passed the motion saying that they'd want the Welsh Government to pursue a continuation bill, which means rather than the EU laws being kept at the UK level, that we freeze EU laws at a Welsh level before it's then at the UK level. So sort of saving what we've already got, but saving it as Welsh law. There's many challenges to actually doing that, because the definition of what's devolved from EU law is not that clear. It's not clear where what's devolved or not. So trying to define this area of what this continuation bill would look like is a really difficult drafting job.
Yeah, an incredibly complex drafting job to try and get the head around how you approach that. And conceptually, how do you do this? How do you make this part of Welsh law at a time when... So you've got your directives, you've got your regulations, they all become part of national law in different ways. Some of those things, EU law says you cannot transpose these into national law. Things like regulations, you shouldn't take national enabling legislation to put it into force. It has automatic force within a national legal system. So, you know, you need to find some sort of device to bring those things in within areas of devolved competence to try and secure these things, to try and concretise these things. But, you know, ultimately, everything falls at the altar of parliamentary sovereignty at the end of this. You know, it would not stop if the UK government felt it was necessary to create UK-wide laws on particular matters to do that.
Yeah, well, if they achieved a Welsh continuation bill and it became, well, there's several stages before the bill getting debated through the Assembly, actually getting to royal assent, getting challenged by the UK government. So all those stages were up for question. But if they achieved it and set that line saying the UK government, this is Welsh law, now come and get us, and force the UK government to pass a withdrawal bill which repeals a Welsh piece of primary legislation, then that's a bigger statement than where we are now. But it's always repealable. Mm-hmm. Sovereignty will always win on this issue.
And there's a bit of a, you know, there's a whiff in the air that we might see this shot across the bows being fired from the Secretary of State, the Welsh Secretary of State, in relation to the Trade Union Act that received royal assent this last week.
Yeah, so should we give a little bit of context there? So the Trade Union Act, what does that do? And what are the public positions that we know about from Welsh and UK govs?
So the UK Trade Union Act was passed, I think, last year. And it restricts the power to strike. It puts thresholds on how many votes trade unions need to, before they can go on strike action and that type of thing. So the Welsh government, obviously fundamentally opposed to that notion, passed a Welsh trade union bill, which removes some of those restrictions and puts it in the same position as we are now, more or less.
Sorry, but yeah. I mean, it did that without having formal competence in the area of industrial relations and employment rights. I mean, that's one of the critical things, is that that area as a whole is not devolved, but that it reached out and sort of claimed competence in those areas through the powers it's got over public services.
Yeah, because we're still in this conferred powers model, the 2006 model, where there is some leeway around the edges, where if we look at the agriculture sector case that the Supreme Court said, if it's realistically possible or related to a devolved area, then you may be able to stretch your powers. Mm. But when the Wales Act comes into force in April next year, there's a totally different line of what's within competence. Mm-hmm.
And the UK government has explicitly said that it plans to explore repealing.
They haven't challenged it through the legislative process.
Well, the Secretary of State, there was when it received royal assent, there was a letter that basically said things may change when the Wales Act comes into force related to competence issues, that, you know, when it is quite clear that this area does not fall within competence, then expect to see a piece of legislation rectifying the situation. That's definitely sort of the reading that you can take from what was said by the Secretary of State, because what happens with the shift from the conferred to the reserved powers model is that employment stops being a sort of a silent area and becomes explicitly reserved. And so there's that statement that, well, it's going to be clear as day then that this is no longer within Welsh competence. So, you know, there will be potentially UK-wide legislation on this once more.
Well, this is looking rather bleak. So
now for some
let's try and cheer us. Let's cheer ourselves up and talk about some public attitudes here. So one of the things that was raised in the event earlier this week was that Baroness Morgan of Ely, she referred to public attitudes about Brexit and suggested that she had heard no evidence to the contrary that public attitudes in Wales had shifted. And we can chastise her for not paying day-to-day attention to the Welsh political barometer, because there was a slight shift in the latest results.
Well, a slight shift, although pretty much within the standard margins of error. I mean, what we've seen since the referendum in June last year is that, certainly in terms of the headline figure on how people say they would vote now in the referendum, not a great deal has changed. We've seen little movements up 2 or 3 percentage points from poll to poll. But broadly speaking, things in the polls for several months leading up to the referendum were very close, and they've still been very close. So the latest poll has the Remainers slightly ahead. But I'd caution people about thinking that, you know, this is the start of a general shift in that direction, that we've reached some sort of tipping point. It may well simply be the sort of random fluctuation you get from poll to poll. What I think is more interesting in some respects, and certainly is much clearer in all of the detailed evidence that we have from various Welsh political barometer polls, also in a more detailed survey that Cardiff University has just conducted with YouGov, which we'll be publishing more details of over the autumn. What comes out very clear there is that there continue to be very stark differences between those who voted Remain and those who voted Leave. Stark differences in terms of what sort of Brexit, if any Brexit at all, they want, what their expectations are of the consequences of Brexit for themselves, for their communities, for Wales, and so on. And also in terms of the politics of, you know, if some deal is reached between Britain and the EU, you know, whether that should just be implemented immediately or whether there should be a much more convoluted process of ratification that might involve, you know, needing the approval of the devolved legislatures or even a second referendum. Commonly after major constitutional referendums, you see some sort of consensus emerging, people sort of rallying behind the flag of whatever was decided. But we don't see that on Brexit at all. The Remainers and the Leavers look at this issue very differently, and those differences are as stark today as they were in June last year.
But it strikes me as if this carries on with the ticking clock that we know is happening, and we have to have some kind of solution by the end of March 2019, it almost feels like there's a little bit of push and pull between the two governments. And I just wonder if is there any indication in the survey data that we have about who people prefer to see handling these different issues?
Well, I mean, when we've asked people in Wales, you know, which level of government should make the major decisions on matters of foreign policy and so on, then people still think that's an appropriate competence to lie at the UK level. I mean, you know, there isn't substantial pro-independent sentiment in Wales. There is clear majority support for some degree of autonomy within the UK, but not for going as far as independence. And, you know, matters like negotiations with the EU would seem fairly obviously to be things that the UK government should handle. Nonetheless, I think you're quite right in suggesting that we do seem to be at the moment very much on course for, you know, the current disputes to get worse. And the UK government at the moment is in a position where it is facing a situation, you know, the negotiations with the EU do not appear to be going well in most respects. But also the internal politics within the UK is not, in plenty of respects, being managed well and effectively. And I think in both sort of the outward-facing EU side of negotiations and in the internal politics, I think we're in a position where, as was once said by a very lugubrious former boss of mine, things are not so bad that they cannot get much worse.
Let's try and find a source of optimism here. Do we think that the EU withdrawal bill, after it goes through committee stage, can it be improved to meet and to respond to a lot of the criticisms that we've seen from the UK Parliament and also from the devolved? Do we think that on the timeline that the UK government is working to, that these problems can be addressed satisfactorily?
The fundamentals of the bill are not going to change, and that's what people want to see change. They're still going to be quite wide, or very wide, any of the eight powers. It's still not going to be very good for the devolved administrations. But will some compromises in terms of giving devolved administration some more flexibility, and will some compromises in terms of requiring the government to bring things before Parliament sooner, will that be enough? Will that be satisfactory? Well, we'll have to wait to see. But we've also got, if this doesn't pass, then what happens next? And that's a,
I mean, in terms of what might be possible, you know, the suggestions from the legislative consent memoranda themselves saying, you know, the devolved governments are saying you get rid of that new restriction that's there. So you've got clause 11, and what you say is that the devolves are no longer subject to the constraint of EU law, full stop. Yeah. And you don't reintroduce any new reservations, and that we tighten up the controls over devolved delegated legislation. Mm. And there are various things that you could do in that sort of to protect the powers of the devolved ministers and legislation within that. So from, you know, the possibilities there. But all of that has to play out then within a political context. You know, what is then done with this? What do we then see with the new agreements that might then be reached going forward? And then that takes us back to how do the different governments in the UK work together as things stand? And we know that there are significant weaknesses and problems within that, and that it is not in any way sort of a heavily institutionalized process, that there are sort of vulnerabilities within that. And so the legislation, this withdrawal bill legislation, I think I heard it referred to on Tuesday as like a mini constitution for post-Brexit Britain, that's the form it's going to be. But, you know, there's all sorts of key principles that we want to see within that, and it'd be one part of that. But it's, you know, how will this then work in practice when we look at the relations between the different parts?
So I genuinely would like to try and find something optimistic. I mean, one of the things that the First Minister has said over and over again is that Brexit has within it the potential for the breakup of the UK. But it also has...
Sorry, I think you're leaving something positive.
Well, yeah. Okay. I'm getting there.
Yes.
But also, it may also help reshaping a more robust UK for the future. That's one of the things that might come out of it. Do you think that one of the things that might come out of Brexit is perhaps more clearly defined UK? There was a lot of talk about the unwritten constitution and how flexible, how constructively ambiguous it can be. But maybe there is a degree of codification that is needed.
Yeah. And this should be a profound constitutional moment for the United Kingdom. And this should be an opportunity to rethink what we have and to bring together some agreed common principles to then, you know, set our constitutional order for the future. But, you know, I think realistically we'll just have a sort of a patchwork of ad hocery. Mm-hmm.
It's what we've seen in the promise of powers. Powers will eventually be devolved to the Welsh Government, the Welsh Assembly. But there's no principles to that. There's no set deadlines. There's no indication of which powers and which types would or wouldn't be. There's no guidance or criteria for that. So the fact that we'll be developing ad hoc, power by power, decision by decision, just seems to be the way we'll develop.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been some progress in the internal discussions within the Labour Party. Certainly if you're looking at it from the First Minister's point of view, he's a less lonely voice, and there are other serious figures within the Labour Party willing to think quite radically about the future of the Constitution. I think even within the Labour Party, this is far from a battle that has been won. I think particularly in a great deal of the party in England is still very reluctant to think about the sort of fundamental constitutional transformation that the First Minister has been advocating for some years. And I think we should remember that for most of its history, the Labour Party has actually been constitutionally quite a small-c conservative entity. And within the Conservative Party, who will still control the UK government, more or less, you know, there is very little appetite at all for thinking radically about some sort of fundamental constitutional transformation of the UK. I think more generally, there is a broader problem that, you know, so much of the sort of political administrative bandwidth, to use a metaphor, is being consumed by the immediate management of the Brexit process, that the sort of, you know, very wide scale and detailed thinking that would need to be undergone to make serious plans for some sort of fundamental constitutional reshaping of the United Kingdom simply is not being done.
Guys, you guys are killing me today. Right, okay, on that subject, I think I've got something that is a positive-ish finish, okay?
Yeah. Well, the water poll was published this week. I mean, what more positive can there be? Sorry.
Do we think the EU withdrawal bill is going to be successfully amended and enacted on the timeline that the government expects?
Ultimately, yes, I think it'll be pushed through, and it'll take anything that it needs to take in its wake, whether that's negative legislative consent motions. You know, it will be, there's a job of work that needs to be done, and it will go through.
Yeah, I mean, something will be done, something will be passed, whether it is a particularly good bill, whether it is managed without substantial political cost, I have serious doubts. But yeah, some piece of legislation will almost certainly make it through. Whether it is actually adequate to the tasks ahead of us is much more doubtful.
Yeah, there's a firm deadline. The MPs won't want to be seen as trying to reverse Brexit. They've got constituents who voted for Brexit, so ultimately it will pass. May reach a stage where there's a negative legislative consent motion and they reject it, and that's a huge hurdle as well. But
it'll be constitutionally fascinating.
Fascinating. It's a change from interesting, which is nice.
And there we have it. That is the high point. That's the optimistic outlook. Constitutionally fascinating. Thank you very much, Dr. Joe Hunt.
Thank you.
Professor Roger Scully.
Yeah.
And Dr. Hugh Pritchard. Yeah. Thanks for listening to Goli, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.